Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to continue our examination of the assassination of Martin Luther King on April 4th of 1968. As in our previous segments, we're going to rely on a marvelous new book entitled Orders to Kill. That was authored by William F. Pepper, P-E-P-P-E-R, subtitled The Truth Behind the Murder of Martin Luther King, published in hardcover by Carolyn Graff and copyrighted 1995. Dr. William F. Pepper is currently one of the attorneys for James Earl Ray, the patsy in the assassination of Martin Luther King. He's described on the jacket as follows. Dr. William F. Pepper is James Earl Ray's attorney. He is a barrister in England, a U.S. attorney, and an associate of the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators. He practices international human rights and constitutional law from London, has represented governments and heads of state, and appeared as an expert on international law issues. He has published two other books and various articles. In accessing information from Orders to Kill, we have focused on two major elements of the conspiracy to kill Dr. Martin Luther King. One was a civilian operation, although obviously controlled by the national security establishment. This involved organized crime elements associated with Carlos Marcello's organized crime empire in the American Southwest. Carlos Marcello was based in New Orleans, an individual whose name has been mentioned in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. Marcello, in turn, utilized some Memphis contacts, including a longtime organized crime operative and Marcello associate named Frank Liberto, and two fellows, one of whom was a gun-running associate of the Marcello organization, also a fellow with intelligence connections named Raul. His last name is presented as the pseudonym of Pereira. That is not his real last name. Raul is his real first name. He also was the individual who was trafficking around James Earl Ray and helping to set him up as the patsy. Also a fellow named Lloyd Jowers, who was charged with overseeing the weapon that Raul used apparently to kill Dr. Martin Luther King. Jowers was in charge of that both before and after the assassination, one of the contact points being that Jowers, who ran Jim's Grill immediately adjacent to the rooming house in which James Earl Ray supposedly fired the fatal shot, Jowers was a gambling associate of Frank Liberto and owned him a lot of money. Backing up the so-called civilian assassination conspiracy, and we took a look at the untimely death of William Sartor, a Time magazine correspondent who had begun unraveling the organized crime connection to the assassination of Martin Luther King. However, it is important to understand that the, quote, civilian, unquote, scenario was part of a coordinated plot which originated with the highest levels of power in the national security establishment. Many people in positions of power in the 1960s felt that Dr. Martin Luther King's opposition to the war in Vietnam might lead to a fusing of the American civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and elements of the black and brown power movements. Indeed, there were motions in that direction. It was also believed by some that eventually there could be a violent revolution or civil war in the United States. I don't concur with that opinion. I don't believe the progressive sector or so-called progressive sector could have gotten it together enough to do that. However, it's important to understand that people in positions of power in this country did feel that and felt that any means necessary should be utilized to prevent that possibility. As such, there was an 8-man Special Forces Alpha Team 184, a Green Beret team, which was operating under the auspices of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, and their snipers were focusing, actually were sighted in on Dr. King and Andrew Young to kill them when the fatal shot from the civilian conspiracy or the civilian end of the conspiracy felled Dr. King, and they were then evacuated from Memphis. In our last several segments, we've looked at very compelling documentation presented by William Pepper of the role of Army intelligence and elements of the 20th Special Forces Group, a reserve unit based in Birmingham, Alabama, from which the Alpha Team 184 was recruited. We also took a look at the fact that the Alpha Team 184 also had a couple of people doing photo reconnaissance. One of those individuals, who was presented under the pseudonym of Reynolds, actually photographed the falling Dr. King 4 or 5 times, and his buddy photographed the actual assassin, not James Earl Ray, leaving the scene. What we're going to look at next is the apparent connection between an enigmatic figure who's cropped up in connection with the assassination of Martin Luther King over the years. It is not clear whether he was involved, or if so, at what level, or whether perhaps he's spreading some disinformation and some accurate information. This is a veteran intelligencer named Jack Youngblood, last name Youngblood, who some people feel was the eggs and sausages man. We talked about Jack Youngblood in Radio Free America program number 8, recorded in April of 1985. That is available from Archives on Audio, about which I will have more to say later on in the program. Archives on Audio is a tape duplication service with documentaries on file that present some of the relevant documentation on various subjects, including the assassination of Martin Luther King. What we're going to do first is to take a look at some of the information concerning Jack Youngblood and the Eggs and Sausages Man and a number of other mysterious people who cropped up shortly after the assassination of Martin Luther King and purported to know about this. It's not clear if Jack Youngblood is all of the individuals, these mysterious people, or some of them. However, the story of Jack Youngblood and the Eggs and Sausages Man, perhaps one and the same, winds throughout the course of the investigation of Martin Luther King. We're first going to examine Jack Youngblood and the Eggs and Sausages Man before examining his apparent connections to some of the people involved with Alpha Team 184. They apparently worked together in Southeast Asia when both were attached to special operation groups in Vietnam. Of Jack Youngblood, the Eggs and Sausages Man, and a number of other mysterious individuals who may be one or the and or the other, William Pepper writes as follows. More determined than ever to examine the official story, I went back to Memphis and turned my attention to Jim's Grill. In 1968, Lloyd Jowers told Chastain, that's Wayne Chastain, a former reporter for the Memphis Press Scimitar and now co-counsel with William Pepper for James Earl Ray. Continuing, in 1968, Lloyd Jowers told Chastain about a mysterious stranger who was in the grill on the afternoon of April 4th and again the following morning ordering eggs and sausage both times. Jowers described him as well-dressed and definitely out of place. Following police orders when the man appeared on the 5th, Jowers called the police who arrived and took the man in, only apparently to release him soon afterward. Wayne Chastain maintained that many of the black people who had been in the grill at the time of the shooting had never been identified. He had tried unsuccessfully to locate and interview each of the black waitresses on duty that afternoon, one of whom, Betty, he had heard had particular significance. Jowers seemed unable to assist him in finding Betty and one other waitress, but arranged for him to interview a third waitress, Rosie Lee Dabney, who had waited on the stranger on the afternoon of April 4th. Chastain had become aware, as a result of the activities of writer William Sartor, a stringer for Time magazine, and investigator Renfro Hayes, that both Jowers and Rosie Lee Dabney had identified the Eggs and Sausage Man from photographs that Sartor had shown them. The photographs depicted a government intelligence asset with ties to Army intelligence and the CIA. His name was Walter Alfred, quote, Jack, unquote, Youngblood. Chastain told me, however, that some 5 years later, when he and reporter Jeff Cohen showed the same photographs to Jowers in a diner one night, Jowers changed his mind. He said that he didn't think that was the man after all. When reminded about his earlier identification, he simply said he thought it wasn't the man. Chastain said that Memphis Police Department Assistant Chief Henry Lux denied taking Youngblood in, but Frank Holloman acknowledged that a man was detained, as did FBI Special Agent in Charge Robert Jensen. Jensen insisted that the man was a gun collector and that his presence had nothing to do with the killing. Chastain believed that this Eggs and Sausage Man was Jack Youngblood, and was the same mysterious person who he heard had visited attorney Russell X. Thompson and local ministers James M. Latimer and John Baltensprager a week or so after the killing. Reverend Latimer identified Youngblood as his mysterious visitor from a photograph Chastain showed him, and attorney Walter Buford, a college classmate and friend of Youngblood, said that Youngblood had called him while in town during that time. I resolved to pursue the story myself. I located and interviewed Lloyd Jowers, a thin, almost anemic man in his late 60s. Puffing on a cigarette, Jowers confirmed Chastain's account of the arrest. I showed him photographs of Jack Youngblood, and he said, "Yup, that's him all right." Attorney Russell Thompson told me that around 10 p.m. on April 10, 1968, he received a call from a man with a Western accent. The caller said that he had just flown into Memphis from his home in Chicago, had heard of Thompson from some friends, and needed to talk to him immediately, but that it was important to speak with him alone. They agreed to meet early the next morning. He described his visitor as being about 6 feet tall, about 35 years old, with light hair and wearing a sombrero. He also had a tattoo of the letters T over S on his arm, which Thompson recalled he could make disappear. He didn't give his name, although he later used the alias Tony Benavides and maintained that a Denver roommate of his, a professional gone as was he, whom he called Pete, shot Dr. King. He said that only a fool would attempt to carry out the killing from a second-floor bathroom window at the end of a corridor because the trees could so easily have deflected a bullet. He said that Pete fired from the bushes, broke the rifle down, putting the barrel down his back, jumped from the wall, and disappeared in the confusion. Thompson was struck by the precise description of the brush and the trees behind the rooming house. This led him to believe that the man knew the area well and could even have been there when it happened. By the way, this individual, Pete, may be an associate from Southeast Asia of both a fellow known as Warren and also Jack Youngblood. Apparently, they all worked together in Southeast Asia on special operation groups for the Green Beret, the military, and the intelligence community. Continuing. In an offhand way, he asked Thompson to represent his friend should he be charged. Benavides said that he himself had been picked up, quote, last Friday, unquote, the day the stranger in Jim's Grill was arrested, and was turned loose after being taken up to the rooming house. Thompson heard from this man only once more in a brief phone call in which he said it didn't appear that legal assistance would be required after all. Thompson gave a full report to MPD Inspector N. E. Zachary and William Lawrence of the FBI. Less than 4 hours after the mysterious stranger left Thompson's office on April 11th, the Reverend James Latimer, pastor of the Cumberland Presbyterian Church at the time, received a telephone call just as he was heading off to lunch with his friend Reverend John Baltensprager. The caller said he needed some, quote, spiritual guidance, unquote, or else he was going to, quote, commit suicide, unquote. The two ministers went to a steakhouse called Jim's Place and met a rather smartly dressed man wearing tinted sunglasses, a blue sports coat, dark trousers, and boots. He was described as having dark, wavy hair, long sideburns, and a dark complexion. He was about 6 feet tall and had an athletic build. At Latimer's suggestion, they went to Rubilio's cafeteria in South Memphis, where there was more privacy. The man identified himself as J. Christ Bonavecchi, B-O-N-N-E-V-C-H-E, and said that on the afternoon that Dr. King was killed, he was employed as a runner for the mafia. Latimer asked Bonavecchi whether he had killed Martin Luther King. The man said, "No, but I know who did," unquote. He seemed to be implying that there was an organized crime connection with the killing, but it didn't really make much sense to the ministers. He said that he was a drug addict and rolled up his sleeves to show the ministers a scar on the inside of his elbow. As he did so, they noticed an intertwined tattoo, T over J, similar to the T over S that Attorney Thompson had noticed. Bonavecchi reportedly also said that his friend, quote, Nick, unquote, killed Dr. King. He said that Nick was very much like himself in personality and interests. He told them that Nick had entered and left town on a motorcycle, and that when he exited, he had the murder weapon strapped onto his back, having previously discarded the rifle stock. Reverend Latimer indicated, however, that a good deal of the discussion focused on the Kennedy assassination, which he said Bonavecchi maintained was a mafia hit. His mysterious visitor also said that Robert Kennedy was next and that he would definitely be assassinated if he won the California primary. This is, of course, exactly what happened. Reverend Latimer also reported this conversation to Inspector Zachary, who promised, as he had with Thompson, to, quote, check it out, unquote. I wouldn't be able to speak with Reverend Latimer for a number of years, but Russell Thompson talked with him about this incident. Thompson said he had no doubt that the man who visited him was the same person who spoke with the ministers. Thompson said he never received a satisfactory explanation or a report back from Inspector Zachary or the FBI, and when I showed him Jack Youngblood's picture, he seemed uncertain, but thought that he could have been the man. Though his visitor was about the right age, Thompson had described him as being light-haired. All the photographs I had of Youngblood were of a dark-haired man. If Youngblood had been his visitor, he must have been in disguise. Youngblood did appear to match the description of a man who appeared at the St. Francis Hotel in Los Angeles shortly after the assassination. This man was with a James Earl Ray lookalike who appeared to have a great deal of money to throw around and who openly spoke of a second killing that was soon to take place. Remember that during his stay in Los Angeles in late 1967 to early 1968, Ray had lived for some time at the St. Francis Hotel and was known there. Month later, I would meet Jack Youngblood on two occasions. He said that he knew some people who had direct information about the killing. They were now living outside of the country, and for a sum of money, he might be able to get them to tell their story. When pressed as to why these overseas contacts would be willing to sit down and reveal what they knew about this case, considering that there is no statute of limitations for murder, he said that the main reason was because they were disenchanted after having provided long and effective service to their government. They now felt that they were being sold down the river, forgotten. He claimed that he had an oil company plane at his disposal. Because of his intelligence connections and activity, it was possible that he knew people who were involved. At the end of the day, I came to believe that it was unlikely that he had had any direct involvement in the case. It seemed that either he was acting on behalf of the government, spreading false information or disinformation, in order to confuse and divert the investigation away from the truth, or he was holding out the promise of information in an effort to hustle money. Though I arranged some funds for him, he never produced the mysterious expatriate government operatives. In this next segment, we're going to examine the member of Special Forces group, of the 20th Special Forces Group, Alpha Team 184, whom William F. Pepper has named Warren. That's not his real name. Real members of the team, and Pepper had obtained a list from a former military intelligence operative who had helped to select these team members. Of the actual team members, living team members are referred to by pseudonyms. Dead members are referred to by name and frequently their real names and frequently service numbers. Now, the member of the Alpha Team 184 from 20th Special Forces Group, whom William Pepper calls Warren, appears to have known Jack Youngblood when the two worked together on covert operations in Vietnam, and like many of the members of Alpha Team 184, they worked apparently for the 1st Special Operations Group based in Can Tho. That's capital C-A-N, capital T-H-O. I would also note that Jack Youngblood was apparently seen by Warren in the company of some of the Carlos Marcello gun-running personnel, of whom Raul was a member. Raul appears to have been James Earl Ray's controller and quite possibly an individual who fired the fatal shot that killed Martin Luther King. I would also note that Jack Youngblood appears to have worked in conjunction with Kenneth Bernstein, that's a longtime intelligence operative, convicted drug smuggler, who was an associate of Mitchell Werbel's and may have been involved with the late Mitchell Werbel in covert operations involving drug smuggling and anti-communist death squad activity in Latin America. We talked about that in conjunction with the recent arrest of Robert Vesco in Cuba, along with Donald Nixon Jr., the nephew of Richard Nixon, under whose auspices Robert Vesco worked, apparently in conjunction with Mitchell Werbel. We recorded that. We have relayed that information, or I relayed that information, in a recently broadcast segment. Of the apparent connections between Jack Youngblood, the 20th Special Forces Group Alpha Team 184 veteran named Warren, and quite possibly Kenneth Bernstein, as well as some of the people involved in Carlos Marcello's gun-running operations, the author William Pepper writes as follows. This, by the way, locates Jack, the mysterious and enigmatic Jack Youngblood, with the same milieu from which the Special Forces team teams that were there to act as backup assassins were recruited. In response to a question about whether or not he knew or had known Jack Youngblood, the one-time government operative and mercenary who had long been on the periphery of the King case, Warren said he remembered him well from the time they served together in Vietnam, when Youngblood was assigned to a highly classified covert special operations group based in Can Tho, the 1st Special Operations Group, which was financed and controlled by the CIA and involved in dirty work, sabotage, assassinations, and special operations throughout Southeast Asia. Warren also flew several missions with Youngblood when the latter was with the Air Studies Group based at Nha Trang. He said that he had last seen Youngblood in the summer or early fall of 1967 on one of his gun-running deliveries to New Orleans. He saw Youngblood with Zippy Chimento, C-H-I-M-E-N-T-O, the coordinator of Carlos Marcello's gun-running operations, in which Warren and, from what Sid Cartu and Cheryl independently said, apparently Raul Pereira were also involved. Interrupting Raul Pereira was apparently the Raul who was trafficking around James Earl Ray and who may very well have been the individual who fired the shot that killed Martin Luther King. Continuing, he recalled that Youngblood had flown in with, quote, Ken Burns or something, unquote. I came to believe that he was referring to Ken Bernstein, who was involved both in gun running and drug smuggling. Bernstein hired Youngblood as a pilot for his Fort Lauderdale airplane taxi company, Florida Atlanta Airlines, but Youngblood also worked for an Alabama arms dealer by the name of Stuart F. Graydon, G-R-A-Y-D-O-N. Bernstein, who was convicted of drug smuggling in 1974, died in a plane crash in 1976. He was also the main illegal weapons procurer for Mitchell Livingston Rebell III, who was a freelance asset of the CIA and who built and supplied weapons through Central America and eventually Southeast Asia for the agency in the 1960s. Now, 16 years after I first met and interviewed him in 1978, it appeared clear that though apparently not himself involved, Jack Youngblood did know at least one of the people on the scene at the time of the killing. It occurred to me that the people he talked about my obtaining information from in 1978 could very well have been these former Vietnam War buddies Warren and Murphy, since Youngblood said that the people he wanted me to meet believed that they had been sold down the river by their government after many years of faithful service and now lived outside of the country. Warren and Murphy certainly had a grievance against the government, having left the country because they believed that they were to be killed. It was ironic that 16 years later, I would independently obtain their story. The next segment of Orders to Kill that William Pepper, the next piece of information that William Pepper presents in Orders to Kill concerns the fact that there was a black military intelligence operative named Merrill McCullough operating under the auspices of the 111th Military Intelligence Group, who was not only spying on Martin Luther King, but who actually was attending to the fallen Dr. King and was photographed checking for vital signs from the fallen Dr. King. Of Merrill McCullough and his work for the 111th Special Intelligence Group, William Pepper writes as follows. Warren also said that he had heard, quote, scuttlebutt, unquote, or rumors that the 111th Military Intelligence Group, or MIG, had a black agent inside Dr. King's group. Using an intelligence source with access to different personnel data banks, I asked for a check to be completed on Merrill McCullough, who I had previously confirmed from two independent sources had gone to work for the CIA in the 1970s. The report bore fruit. McCullough was not what he appeared to be. He had been in the regular army between February of 1964 and December of 1966, and was a military policeman or MP. Then, on June 16th, 1967, he was reactivated and hired as an Army intelligence informant and attached to the 111th Military Intelligence Group headquartered at Camp McPherson, Georgia. Thus, McCullough had ultimate reporting responsibility to the 111th Military Intelligence Group, though he was deployed to the Memphis Police Department as an undercover agent and officially reported to MPD Lieutenant E. H. Arkin. He was apparently shocked and surprised when the shooting occurred. It is unlikely that he was aware as he knelt over Dr. King that the 20th Special Forces Group sniper teams were in the wings with the prone body of Martin King and the erect form of Andrew Young, center mass, in their scopes. And again, one of the photographs of the fallen Dr. King taken shortly after he was shot shows Merrill McCullough checking him for vital signs. And again, Merrill McCullough, a veteran intelligencer, an African-American, and working at the time with the 111th Military Intelligence Group. The Alpha Team 184, recall, was working under the auspices of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group. So Warren's, quote, scuttlebutt appears to have been right on the money. The last item that we're going to go into, the last element of information that we're going to go into in this segment, concerns the identification by Warren, again a pseudonym, of an individual who was photographed coming down off of a wall. He appears to be in the uniform of a Memphis policeman. He was photographed coming down off a wall shortly after the assassination. He was identified by Warren as a former associate of his on various special operations in South Vietnam, apparently working for the National Security Agency, according to Warren, at the time that the photograph was taken. Returning to Orders to Kill, we read, I forwarded a photograph to Warren to see if he could identify either of two persons coming down over the wall, quite obviously shortly after the killing, since uniformed police were shown in the photograph running up Mulberry Street. The two figures were hatless and wearing some kind of uniform. One of them appeared to be wearing a small military-issue sidearm. Warren was quick to respond. He didn't recognize the figure farthest away, but the man closest to the camera, bending over as he prepared to jump down from the wall, he knew from his days in Vietnam as someone who had been assigned to the 1st Special Operations Group in Can Tho. He named him and said he believed that in Vietnam he was associated with either the CIA or the NSA, and that in 1968 he was working for the NSA. I thought it possible that he might have been seconded to another agency for this operation. Interagency sharing or secondment of such personnel was a regular practice. One wonders whether perhaps that was the individual that Jack Youngblood also apparently associated with Warren and some of the other people from Alpha Team 184 when they were all in Vietnam, whether the fellow identified as Pete, apparently by the Eggs and Sausages man, and the individual who fired from the bushes near the wall, whether that might have been the individual that Warren identified from his days in Vietnam, or as an associate from their days in Vietnam, I should say. Note that it may be possible that Raoul fired a shot, but that the actual fatal shot or another bullet struck Dr. King, fired from this individual known as Pete, or perhaps the individual who was the identified by Warren as a former colleague from Southeast Asia. I referred earlier in this program to a tape duplication service named Archives on Audio. They have documentaries containing extracts from the printed sources upon which the lines of argument presented on this broadcast are based. Those documentaries, called archive shows, are on permanent file. Archives on Audio can be contacted at P.O. Box 170023, Box 170023. That's in San Francisco, zip code 94117-0023. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. There is a 20-page catalog available which lists all of the archive shows, gives a synoptic description of each one, and cross-references the programs with other broadcasts containing similar or related material. Those listeners who have access to the World Wide Web can access the web page for KFJC-FM, the station in Northern California on which I record these segments. The KFJC web page can be accessed as follows. The following are all lowercase letters. http://www.cygnus.com/misc/KFJC/HTML. One more time, that's http://www.cygnus.com/misc/KFJC.html. Also, people hunting for rare titles in this field of research should contact Antifa Book Service. That's A-N-T-I-F-A Book Service. They are located at 945 Taravel Street, T-A-R-A-V-A-L Street. That is in San Francisco, number 117, 945 Taravel Street, number 117, San Francisco, California, 94116. And again, that's a book search service which can hunt down rare titles in this line of work. That concludes this particular segment. In the next segment, we're going to take a look at one of the identities that was assumed by James Earl Ray when he was on the lam. This identity points up to the possible involvement of the National Security Agency in some elements of the killing, and the evidence suggests, is still more evidence, indicating that the assassination of Martin Luther King was an interagency operation planned at the highest levels of the U.S. government. However, the details concerning the mysterious Eric S. Galt will be presented in our next segment. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.